Friends, my wife and I, Robin, have gone into our last long haul. Our youngest has got his L plates, and as you know, that now means 120 hours, count them, 120 hours sitting in a car while someone is trying to learn how to drive. And at that point, you start to ask serious questions about the parentage of certain politicians who came up with this wild idea. And I want to ask, what competition did I win that gained me an extra 70 hours sitting in a passenger seat on top of the 50 hours that with the last two children, while I surreptitiously hold the handbrake with my right hand, the car door with my left hand, and the seat with my buttocks, holding on for this thing for dear life while I teach a child to drive? But I digress. Our child will be a good driver. He already has got a good start on life, as our other two children are good drivers. And the fascination is this, that we have trained our two elders so far to such a degree that we are confident in their ability to drive, to the point that we don't wait up for them when they go out. When they take the car and go out, I just go to bed, my wife goes to bed, we turn the light off and go to sleep. Now, you may want to now report me to docs and the police for child abuse, and that's your prerogative, of course, but it's just that I've figured that we have trained them to the degree that we are confident in their abilities to handle themselves on the road. So, for example, we trained their eyes. We trained their eyes to see a couple of cars in front. So I say to each of my children, when you see two or three cars in front, the stoplights come on, you start slowing down before the guy in front of you props, because he's not seeing it. And if a ball shoots out across the street, start to slow up, because a child will be chasing the ball. And the child just can't handle the idea of traffic. They just want to get their ball. If a dog or a cat comes racing across in front of you, I tell them, now I love dogs, I have one. Cats are okay. But I tell my children, do not swerve and do not hit the brakes, because the lives of your passengers and the lives of other human beings in other cars are far more valuable than the lives of a dog or a cat. You can replace a dog, you can replace a cat, but you cannot replace a broken human body. So we teach our children to see well when we train them. And because we've trained them, I'm confident that they'll just be good drivers. And sometimes I have to admit that as I train my children right now, and with my youngest, I'm saying, using it as a bit of a carrot, for every hour of homework you do, there's 15 minutes in the car with me on the weekend. Simple, really, you do the math. 1 hour of homework, 15 minutes in the car. 4 hours of homework, that's 1 hour, you do the math. Though I'm not like another minister I had heard of, who when his son got his P's, the son started to negotiate for the car, and he said, you know, can I have the car? And Dad said, I'll tell you what, you pick up your grades at school, study the Bible a little more and get your hair cut, we'll cut a deal in a month's time. So kid went away, came back a month later, his dad said, you've done really well. Your grades have picked up. That's great. I've noticed you've been reading your Bible a little more, studying that a bit better. You didn't get your hair cut. And the son just stood there smugly and said, I thought you'd say that. Because as I've been studying the Bible, I noticed that Moses had long hair. Samson had long hair. Jesus even had long hair. And the dad said, yes. And they walked everywhere they went too. So we go to sleep, and I figure if there's an accident or something goes wrong, they've got mobile phones, they've got my number, they'll call. If it's a serious accident, and we hope that it never is, but if it's a serious accident, the police will wake us up and we'll deal with the issues then and there. Staying awake and worrying about it is not going to help them at all. Now, does this mean I don't love my kids? Not at all. It just means that we've trained them to the degree that we trust them with a car and trust them with the lives of people in the car. A part of our training has to be develop in them a trustworthiness. Now, you know that trust develops in the gap between what I say I will do and what I do. What I place in that gap builds trust or erodes it. So we've taught our children to be trustworthy, to be men and a woman of their word. If they say they'll do something, then they will do it. So that means when they go out driving, we know that they will keep to the speed limit, they won't drink and drive, and they won't act a goat on the road, because we've taught them to be trustworthy. Now, of course, this trustworthiness is not just for driving cars, it's also for the whole of life. Because a man knows that if he is trustworthy, his lover will entrust her heart to him for life. And a woman knows that if she's trustworthy, her children will entrust themselves to her all of their days. Employees know that if they are trustworthy, then their employer will give them greater responsibility. Trustworthiness is a big thing, and we've taught our children to be trustworthy men and women. We're in a series right now called Building a Life When Making a Living is Paramount. Building a life when making a living is paramount. It's one thing to build a child's life, but how do you build your life when making a living is paramount? How are you going with that? It's one thing, you might say to yourself, oh, I might get a life coach, spend all the money. Is that what you do? You spend money and get a life coach? Well, the God of the Bible says that would not be the best use of your money. In fact, God says, I will use your money to build your life. I will use the money that you have access to build your life. It's a kind of surprise, really. God uses money, our wealth and our possessions, to build a life for us. The Bible makes it very clear that God is the one who allows us to have access to all the wealth we do, the money and the possessions that we do. And he's using them to train us that we might be trustworthy and we might build lives that are worth living. You see at the end of that Bible reading that Marty read out for us, where Jesus says, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Now, there's a few things to pull out of this. The first one is this. God uses money because it reveals our trustworthiness. Do you hear what Jesus said? Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little is dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? Any employer knows that if you have an employee who you can't trust with $10, you're not going to give them a portfolio worth $10 million, are you? Any parent knows that if you can't trust the child to take care of the car when you're sitting in the passenger seat right there with them, while you're teaching them to drive, then you're not going to give them the car when they get their P's. If they cannot take care of things when there is no risk for them, then why would you give them things to care for that put them directly at risk? And that's what Jesus is saying here when he says, if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Can you remember Kerry Packer? Big luminary on our horizon in Australia for so many years. Do you recall how he trained his son James to take over the empire? He spent years doing that. It's not because James was the eldest. There are two or three older brothers and sisters than James, but for some reason Kerry picked James out and then spent time training him. He wanted to do that because Kerry himself had invested his life in taking the empire that his father had given him and turned it into a multi-billion dollar empire that made him not just Australia's richest man, but one of the world's wealthiest men. The wealth of Kerry Packer is seen in a story that was told when he was gambling in Las Vegas, playing cards at the millionaire's table. And while he was playing cards, one of the players around the table was loud-mouthed and kept going on and on and on about how much he was worth. And it just got under Kerry's goat. So at one time, Kerry said to him, how much are you worth? And the guy sat back and said, a couple of $100 million. So Kerry pulled out his checkbook, wrote a check. What's your name? $200 million, put that in the middle of the table, so let's bet. Kerry Packer put James Packer into relatively small operations to see how he would fare. How would he go with the board of this part of the empire? How would he go with the pushback from the board directors? How would he go with the pressure of running that part of the organisation? How would he go with the accolades and the criticism that would come because of the decisions that he would make in that part of the empire? If James Packer was not able to handle that level of complexity, then Kerry was not going to give him the whole empire until James was ready. Kerry was forever testing the trustworthiness of James Packer so that he could then entrust the empire to James. And I have no doubt that Kerry Packer began that education when James was quite small, going out to lunches with business people, having business people over for lunch at the house, meeting business leaders on trips, and being sent to particular schools to learn how to think in particular ways. All aimed at shaping and grooming James Packer for the great responsibility and the great reward of inheriting the Packer Empire. All of that is what lies behind Jesus' words when he says, "Whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much." So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches, Jesus says. Now, it's interesting here. Jesus is saying there are true riches. And I, for the life of me, cannot really nail down exactly what the true riches are. Jesus doesn't make it clear. But there is an indication, I think. At the very end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation, we are told that the streets of heaven will be paved with gold. And so when we get to heaven, to hanker after a little gold really doesn't make a whole lot of sense, really. That will be like sitting at home this afternoon hoping that the lotto numbers come your way and the lotto truck turns up with a truckload of bitumen. It's worthless to you. In the world to come, the riches that we handle now will be worthless to us. There are far greater riches that Jesus wants to give his people. But in order to give it to us, he wants to test our trustworthiness. If he can't trust us with money, which he calls very little, then he will not give us great wealth. True riches, he says. And so the second thing we need to do is we need to learn how to be trustworthy. We live in a city and in a society that encourages us to not be very trustworthy with money. You know that we as Australians on average spend $114 for every $100 that we earn? That's not very trustworthy. We need to learn how to do it. And we see that we need to learn things from an experiment that a second grade teacher did with her students one day. She was wanting to teach them the wisdom of the land. And as she was doing that, she put up proverbs on the blackboard. They went like this. She put up the first half. You know, can lead a horse to water, but... dot, dot, dot. Or... a penny saved is, dot, 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 a bird in the hand, can't teach an old dog, if at first you don't succeed. So she put them up, and as she had the children complete them, she realised that she needed to teach them proverbs because they completed them like this. You can lead a horse to water, but he'll only want more. A penny saved is not much. A bird in the hand is liable to go to the toilet on you. Can't teach an old dog much because he can't see very well. And for the mature amongst us, if at first you don't succeed, eat more fruit. So we need to learn, we need to keep on learning this stuff about trustworthiness. So here's some lessons to learn about trustworthiness. All of the Bible's teaching on money can be summed up in three brief statements. Earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. Earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. So, earn as much money as you can and do it enthusiastically and honestly. and use it to provide for your family and for your business, to make sure stock is right, tools are okay. That sort of thing is in place. Earn all you can so you can take care of those necessities. And once you've taken care of those things, then live within your means. Avoid consumer debt like the plague. Debt is not your friend. In the Old Testament, a book called Proverbs says this in Proverbs 22, verse 7. The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is the servant of the lender. And ain't that the truth? The borrower is the servant of the lender. Debt enslaves a man. Debt enslaves a woman, not only to the one to whom they owe money, but also to the need and the pressure to earn more money. Let me do this equation. I've done this before at this service, but let me do it again. It's always instructive to do. Have you ever wondered how long it would take you to pay off your credit card if you today cut up your credit card and just paid the minimum amount? So let's do some sums here. Let's assume for a moment that your credit card has a $5,000 debt associated to that. There is a minimum payment to be made this month. Let's assume that you have $5,000 on one of your credit cards. You cut up your credit card today and do not use it ever again. But what you're committed to doing is paying off the minimum monthly repayment. Have a guess, a wild guess, at how long it will take you to pay that amount of money off. Guess? 10 years? 3 years? 73 years. You can only get one go at this, Tony. Any other guesses? It will take you 30... Let me get this right. It will take you 32 years and 7 months. And it will cost you $7,500 in interest repayments. That means you would spend $12,500 over 32 years and 7 months to pay off that debt. By comparison, if you put that much money into a savings account and it was earning, let's say, 4.5% interest, then at the end of 32 years and 7 months, you would have over $21,000 in the account. Debt is not your friend. So earn all that you can, pay the necessities, and live within your means. And when you do that, you can then save all you can. To save all you can calls for regular disciplined deposits into a savings account. When you get your pay, put a certain amount aside every week. Just put it into a savings account. From out of that savings, you can then pay for holidays, retirement, rainy days, and economic downturns. We've just come through one, and there will be another one that will take place, who knows, 7, 10 years, and there will be another one. Most of us will see 2 or 3 more downturns before we pass this earth. They just come. But if you have some savings, it makes it a little easier to get through. So make all you can, save all you can. And then from that savings account, you can then give all you can. And that means you'll become increasingly like Jesus, who was very generous. Remember from 2 Corinthians 8, 9, we're told that Jesus, though he was rich, became poor, so that we who are poor might become rich. God is extraordinarily generous. And so we need to learn how to be generous. Now, when I was converted quite young, I was converted at the age of 15 and a half, and I was earning a princely sum of $20 a week working at Woolies at Castle Hill for 8 hours a week work. And I got onto the tithing bit really easy. I was able to put 10% of that aside really easy, because $2 out of $20 doesn't sound like a whole lot of money, though I do recall spending $2 to fill my car up, my red Jack Brabham HB Special Tirana. It didn't have a very big tank, but $2 a week it cost me to fill it up. $2 I put into the offertory plate at church. Being generous was something I had to keep learning to do. Now, at the risk I want you to hear, I'm sharing this so you hear the journey and for no other reason. I remember the day my wife and I, newly married pretty much, friends of ours were in straits, dire straits. We were at college still and we had some money and we gathered together our money and it was a lot of money for us as students. We took $500 and gave it to our friends who needed money. As we did that, my throat was dry, my knees were knocking, my heart's pounding, the blood's draining from my face, thinking that could be what we need in a month or two's time. But they need it now. A number of years later, we were able to turn a small inheritance into a modest property in the Blue Mountains, and it needed new carpet. My brother-in-law had put new carpet down in his house, but didn't like it, so he ripped it up. Hadn't been walked on, really. And said, "Do you want the carpet?" We said, "Thank you." Took it to where we were living, and then we discovered friends had more need of new carpet in their house than we did, and so blood drained from a face, throat dry, knees knocking, thinking that would add value to our investment property, but we gave it to them so that they could get out of their straits. We need to keep growing in generosity. Sometimes it can be fun. We go out with friends, and to be quiet, between you and I, these friends are filthy rich. And they take us to really nice restaurants and they won't never let us pay. And he always gets up at the end of the third course, you know, and wanders off and goes to the toilet and on the way back pays the bill. I've watched this. And so we thought we would be generous. We invited them out to dinner and we knew what they were going to do. But we took them to a restaurant that they didn't know. We told them we would meet them at a certain place. Then we walked to the restaurant. And when I got into the restaurant, I said to the head waiter, my friend went past, I said, "This man's money is not worth anything here, okay? When he comes to pay, you say, 'Sir, your money is, we don't accept your money. Your money's not worth anything.'" So at the end of the course, he got up and go to the toilet, do his usual thing, came back, and I watched him with great delight. Because he got to the head waiter and the guy said, "Sorry, sir, your money is not worth anything here. Your credit cards are worthless here. We cannot take your money." He came back a little grumpy, and I just smiled and went and paid. Be a little generous at that point. You can have a bit of fun being generous. Maybe there could be a little pain in your chest as I speak about these things. Maybe a little pain in your hip pocket. Because that's the lure of money. Money has a power to it. And Jesus is saying, "I've trusted you with it. I want to see how trustworthy you are. Will you use it and be generous? Will you earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can, or will you keep it to yourself?" That's why Jesus says in another verse here, in Luke 16, verse 13, "No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other." You cannot serve both God and money. Now, in the ancient world, it was common enough to find slaves who were slaves to more than one master. And the observation was, in the ancient world, that a slave was unable to give total allegiance to both masters. The common observation was they would love one and despise the other, hate one and love the other. And Jesus is saying, what you see in the world around you is true of money and God. You cannot serve both God and money. God calls for your exclusive allegiance because he wants to give you true riches. But if you argue the toss about money, your heart is divided, your pain in your hip and heart is quite acute. There is a formula that you can use. Again, I've shared this here, but let me share it again. There is a formula that you can use called the 10-10-80 formula. Every week when you get paid, or every month whenever you get paid, you can take 10% and give that to an organisation that will make a difference in the world in which we live, that will shape the lives of humanity forever. One of those organisations would be a church like this one, where every cent we receive goes into shaping the lives of human beings. Take 10% and save it, and then live off the 80%. Some of you are going to say, "No, I can't live off 80%. Well, I reckon that if tomorrow you went to work and your boss said, "I've got to drop your salary by 20% or you lose your job," you would make adjustments. You can live on 80%. might have to give up the Foxtel, you might have to give up this, you might have to give, but you'd make the difference. So why not get into the habit now? 10, 10, 80. Now, I shared that a while ago, and David Hobbs came to me after church and said, yeah, that's a cool rule, but I have another one. So, Dave, come on up. I'm going to ask him to share his rule with us that he follows. And again, I find it helpful just to share this sort of stuff with people and to have other people tell me their bits, and so we're going to ask David his. Dave, welcome. So,
thanks, John.
What's the pattern that you follow?
So we have a 10, 10, 10, 70 plan.
Okay, now how does that work?
We were really challenged to go for that plan, and really what we do is we take the 10% that you talked about for the church and 10% for saving, but we were also challenged for another 10% for reducing consumer debt, paying off the credit card consumer debt.
Okay, and why were you challenged to do that?
I'd grappled with God for many years about how much we should be giving and things like that, and I came across some readings, and I really felt that God was telling me that you really just need to be obedient about this, David, and I want you to give 10, 10, 10, 70. I think you should follow that plan, and there was no way I could live on 70%.
But you have.
God said, David, just be obedient, trust me in this, and you can.
And are things okay?
Yeah, that was about 4 or 5 years ago now, and God has blessed us through that time. We've followed that formula, and God has shared many, many blessings on us over that time.
Okay, so you have a little nest egg growing?
Yes.
And you've got your consumer debt under control?
Exactly, yes.
And you're living okay?
Exactly, yep.
Good, thanks, buddy. Take a seat. Thank you so much. Take it back with you. So it might be worth thinking about one of those two formulas, 10, 10, 80, 10, 10, 10, 70. If you will do this, it means that you'll be able to live within your means. Your trustworthiness will increase. It means that God will entrust you with more, and in the end, with true riches. And all of that raises a question in my mind. Why do we have access to so much wealth in this city? Why is it that today, even our 12-year-old children will physically handle more money than 5.7 billion people on the planet will handle today? 5.7 billion people live on $2 a day or less. And after church today, a number of you, including me, will line up for coffee and will gladly hand over $2 for a cup of coffee and not think anything of it. Why have we been given access to so much? Well, it's the last point I want to make. Jesus wants us to use wealth to make friends. He says in verse 9 back here, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so when it is gone, that is when wealth is gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Now this is not simply make friends for yourself here and now. This is to make friends for eternity. These are men and women who one day will welcome us into heaven itself. And it calls therefore for a full view of life. Now, I love living in the hills. I love the birds and the trees and the smells. I just love living here. But this isn't home. This is not heaven. The grandmother I know whose husband held a rifle to her head will tell you that. The husband I know whose wife wants to divorce him will tell you that. The grandfather who watched his sweet little granddaughter pass away will tell you this is not home. They will all tell you that life in the hills is good, but it ain't heaven. And so we need to let other people know this is not heaven. There is a world yet to come, and we need to make friends with them so that when Jesus returns, they will be in heaven as well. We are to use our wealth that's given to us, our homes, our coffee, our barbecue tables, our dining room tables, to have conversations with people who do not yet know Jesus. to use our boats and our holiday homes to have conversations with people so that they will hear about a God who will one day take them home. We may need to learn to see a little better. And so those of you who travel for work, I want to challenge you. When you go to China or when you go to Africa or India or Malaysia or Singapore, I challenge you to get out of your motels. Find someone who will take you to the poor parts of town so you can get the dust of that city in your nostrils like I've got the dust of Kibera slums in mine. And see how people live, how most people live on our planet. And ask the question, how can I use the wealth that I have access to make friends with these people that they might welcome me into eternal dwellings? If you're planning an overseas holiday, that's a great thing. Enjoy that. But if you go to a country like Rob and I had an opportunity a number of years ago to go to Phuket, or the city of Phuket in Thailand, we went from the airport to Phuket past third world shanty towns. And I thought, and I said to Rob, we've got to bring our children back here one day. Never had the opportunity to do that. But some 10 or 12 years after that trip, we had this wonderful opportunity to take our children through the slums of Kibera in Nairobi, so that they could feel the mud of Nairobi on their toes and the smell of the dust in their nostrils, in the hope that they would never, ever forget it and start to think through how can we use the wealth that we have access to make friends with these people. If you can't travel, that's okay. Why don't you drive across the city this afternoon and have coffee at John Street, Cabramatta, and see how another part of our city lives and does not live, and ask the question, how can I use the wealth that I have access to introduce these people to Jesus? You see, there is a time coming when sin will be no more, when Revelation 21:4 will be true, which tells us that Jesus himself, nail-scarred hands, will wipe away all of our tears. There will be a time when there will be no more pain or mourning or crying or death, because those things belong to this side of heaven's door, not the other side. There will come a time when all of that will be over. The grandfather who watched his granddaughter die, he will not have that pain anymore. The woman who had the rifle in her head will not have that pain anymore. There will come a time. And we need to be men and women who have so proved trustworthy that we've used the wealth that we have access to make many friends who will welcome us into heaven. Another part of Luke's gospel, Jesus tells a story about some people who were given money to invest. And when the master returned, he asked for an account. One servant came and said, I just buried it in the ground. And the master said, take his money away from him and throw him out. Two servants came and said, I took the money and I invested it and I made, look at this, and they heard words that I long to hear. There will come a day where I will hope to hear Jesus say, well done, good and faithful servant. Well done, for you were trustworthy with little, and so now I entrust you with much.